This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Vicky Gabarot, sitting in for Michael Enright, and this is a podcast of the Sunday Edition. In his latest book, Murder Without Borders, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places, Terry Gould takes us into the lives of seven journalists who died whilst doing their jobs. These were not war correspondents or superstar TV reporters. Rather, they were local journalists who were reporting in their own countries. They lived where they worked and reported on the corruption that affected the people who lived around them. They all knew they were courting death every time they filed a story, and yet they carried on. A Russian journalist survived being poisoned, yet she continued to write about the plight of Chechens until she was shot, point-blank range, right in front of her apartment building. A Bangladeshi journalist was murdered in front of the local press club, just to set an example. And according to Terry Gould, murder works. It silences the individual journalists as well as those around them. Of the 720 journalists murdered in the line of duty since 1992, three-quarters were targeted to be killed. Most of them were local. Almost none of their killers has been apprehended. Terry Gould first noticed this murder with impunity when he was researching another book in the Philippines. 22 journalists were killed outside Manila between 2000 and 2004, but absolutely no one was ever charged. Terry Gould is an investigative journalist who focuses on organized crime and social issues. He's won 48 awards so far, maybe more, and other honors for his reporting. He is the author of four books. This morning, Terry Gould joins me in our Vancouver studio. Good morning to you. How are you?
Well, thank you, Vicky, for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, well, yeah, it's great. It's a fantastically interesting book, and I'm really, frankly, interested to know why you wanted to write it this way.
Well, I'd always written about why people did bad.
Yeah.
Organized crime figures. And now I wanted to know why they did good. And the epigraph to my book sums up the line of inquiry that I was interested in. It's by Vaclav Havel, and he wrote it in prison. And he said, "I am not interested in why man commits evil. I want to know why he does good." And these journalists, all of them, all the seven journalists that I wrote about whose full life stories I told, predicted they would be murdered. They lived in places where journalists were being murdered all around them. In their towns, 3 or 4 or 6 or 20 had been murdered before them. These were the five most murderous countries for journalists. At the time I started the book in 2005, they were Colombia, the Philippines, Bangladesh, Russia, and Iraq. So I chose representative cases in all these countries, and I set out to tell their life stories, birth to death, to try and explain that psychology of sacrifice that imbued them with the courage to continue reporting on stories even though they were certain they would be murdered for those stories. What drove them? What was it about their lives that made them different from other journalists, other civilians? And why did they stay in the towns, not flee? And after getting that last threat, which said to them from the governor, from the general, from the president, "You will be murdered if you write this next piece." Why they wrote that next piece and, in fact, in some cases, waited for their own deaths.
And what is your conclusion? What do they have in common?
There were two commonalities that I found throughout their lives. One is that they had all gone through a transformational experience, either early in their lives or early in their careers, that convinced them that the weak had to be defended against the powerful at all costs. Something had happened to them. They had witnessed something, or they had done something to others, and out of guilt, grief, or passion for right, they tried to change the societies in which they lived. All these societies, as a third commonality, were governed by what we might call the principle of organized crime, in which the the political ruler or the religious ruler were, in effect, gang bosses. And they would appoint their supporters in the bureaucracies below them. And in return for continuing to support the leader, they were allowed to do whatever they wanted. They knew their salaries would be low, but their incomes would be high. And so corruption was a permissible way to behave, and the poor were robbed and the rulers got rich. And these journalists in all these places saw that they had to change this modus operandi.
They couldn't stand it. They couldn't live in this society without speaking
with
out.
So many people suffering so greatly. And that brings us to the next commonality. And that is that they were not foreign correspondents. When we think of journalists dying on a job, we think of war correspondents caught in a crossfire. But as you said, and there are now 740 journalists that have been murdered.
740.
Yeah. Every day, it gets more. And they did not fly in from someone else to cover these exotic and dangerous lands. They lived where they died, and they died to defend the people where they lived. In other words, they lived in the towns where, in most cases, they were born. They saw their neighbors suffering. They saw their family suffering. They saw the entire city and culture suffering as a result of this principle of organized crime that they were determined to investigate and bring down or at the very least expose. Now, this is not a very difficult concept to understand for people outside these very violent and corrupt milieus. If you live on a block or in a town and gangsters move in and they take over the town and they make your children suffer and your neighbors suffer and your relatives suffer, you might say to yourself, you know what? It's worth dying for to stop these people.
You get braver.
Yeah, you get braver. But where they were different from the rest of us is that they saw their colleagues 3, 4, 20 cut down. And in these places, they don't just kill you, Vicky. They cut your tongue out.
First.
They drill holes in you. They torture you in an unspeakable way. So it's one thing to get your courage and perhaps die for the sake of stopping a nefarious system. But it's another to see others die ahead of you and die ahead of you in horrible ways and still defy threats and still write that story.
Of the people that you have featured in this particular book, none was tortured.
Anna Politkovskaya had been tortured in Russia. Yes.
How had she been tortured?
She her main field of reporting was in Chechnya. And she was in a Chechen town called Katuni in the mountains of Chechnya. And she actually went into a compound where they were torturing prisoners, where the Russian army was torturing prisoners. And she knew what would happen to her, and she went in there, and she was arrested, and she was brought into a room that was controlled by the FSB, which is the new manifestation of the KGB. And she was beaten very badly, and beaten in an expert way, where they beat you in one spot where a hematoma rises, then they go on to another spot, and then they return to that spot, so you dread being hit in that one spot. They went through her purse. They insulted her womanhood. They took out pictures of her children. They said what they would do to her children. They took her outside, and they said that we were going to shoot you. She went through a mock execution. They fired off a salvo over her head. So yet, after that, she was freed about 3 days later, and she went back to it again. So, yes, I would say she was very...
she was tortured.
Yes.
The thing is that sometimes I wondered if some of the actions were folly. In her case, she also had the responsibility of children, as did the woman in the Philippines. As did, almost all of them.
They all had families.
Yeah, they all had families. And they did put their families in jeopardy who didn't necessarily ask for it.
Yeah.
There's a kind of strange martyrdom to it, isn't there, as well?
Yeah, there's that. There is that obsession with the idea that there is a greater good.
Yes.
And also an obsession with the idea that most people are good. They all believed in something like a law of goodness, that natural selection had naturally evolved the fact that most people are good, but that there were miscreants that will take advantage of that and will make the vast majority of people suffer. And in countries which are run according to the principle of organized crime, millions suffer as a result. So they would live with their families, love their families, but yet they would look over the heads of the families, and somehow they would feel the same love for other people's children as they would feel for their own.
Fair enough. Let's talk about a few specifically.
Yeah.
Brava Vega in Colombia.
Yeah.
Now, he's a wild cat. He was a real wild guy.
Now, Bravo Vega lived in a wild place, Vicky. He lived in a town called Neiva at the height of the Colombian Civil War in the early 2000s. He was murdered in 2003. The town was attacked and surrounded by FARC guerrillas, and it was controlled by paramilitaries, and the economic system was in the grip of a very corrupt organization that they call the Opitas Mafia, which was in effect the descendants of the original Spanish colonizers. And since the government was run according to this principle of organized crime where people were getting something for nothing, Bravo targeted the governor.
Not just in print, but on TV.
On TV, insulted him, insulted all his cronies, and he kept that up for a number of years. Now, he was a tall, handsome man. He'd also won the equivalent of the Colombian Pulitzer Prize called the Simon Bolivar Award. He's a brilliant journalist, but he couldn't get along with people in corporate structures. He struck out on his own, like most of these journalists.
Right. Loners, in a way.
Loners, like Davy Crockett.
Like Davy Crockett?
Yeah. Everybody worships him, but no one will ever hire them, right?
Right.
In any case, he knew that women were very, very drawn to him. And in some cases, he would let a lot of women know that he was a danger seeker and a man who stood up to the evil forces of town. And he wound up having three legal wives, one legal and two live-in. And he had five children, and he had a string of mistresses. And there's no doubt that he would reap the benefits of being this Che Guevara type guy.
Wasn't he an illegitimate son of some big shot?
Yeah, that's his transformative experience.
Yeah.
As I said, each one of these had a transformative
experience.
And that
experience. Was his.
He was already born very, very poor, the bastard son of a hacienda owner on a plantation. And his mother was poisoned. He suspected his mother was poisoned by his blood father. And because he got jealous of her, and he was taken into this hacienda and raised as a member of the establishment, and he began to think of himself as the part of the ruling classes. And his father got him a job with the police doing the accounts and the bookkeeping, and he got drunk in a bar one day, and there was a political discussion. He was 23 years old. This is the early 1960s. And he got into an argument with some working men at a table, and one of them said to him, "Bravo, if you're so brave, man, shoot me." So Bravo took out a gun and shot him between the eyes. He was a macho guy.
And drunk.
Yes. And he was so mortified by that, so horrified that what he had done, that even though he was offered the opportunity to get off, he went to prison for years. And while he was in prison, he met trade unionists and socialists. And when he got out of prison, the relatives of the man he'd murdered tracked him down, and he said to them, "I know you have a right to kill me, but if you don't kill me, I will spend the rest of my life making up for that crime and dismantling the system of which I was a part." And he did that. That was at 23 years old, and he worked for the next 40 years to do that. And at the very end of his life, he knew he would be killed.
He lived longer than most.
Yeah, he built up a system of allies in the field.
Then he left his door open.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They just came in and went bang and...
Yeah. He received a last threat. He'd been told to leave town six times, and it survived all kinds of assassination attempts. People were being killed all around him. At the end of his life, he was told, "This is it for you." And he knew the federal police were in on it and that they would get him this time. But he also said something interesting. He said that, "I've been trying for decades. And it's like planting in the desert. I can't change this system. And the people seem to go along with this system." And he was in despair.
Right.
And he was getting old, and women were not paying attention to him as they used to be. So after he received this last death threat, he would sit at his desk with the door open.
waiting for them.
And at night, he was like framed like a picture. And finally, they just walked in through the door and they shot him. But they did it in the way they always kill journalists. They shot him in the heart, in the mouth, and in the head. A message to everyone else. This is not the way to feel. This is not the way to speak. This is not the way to think.
Let's move to the Philippines.
Yeah.
And the first woman you talk about.
Yeah. Marlene Garcia Esperant. She, too, had a transformative experience when she was very young. She had a she was born on the southern island of Mindanao, remotest island of the Philippines. And her father was a heroic figure to her. He, in the very corrupt Mindanao scene, he had become the police chief, and then he had been elected to city council, and he fought for reform against these interconnected forces that were stealing money from the people. And she was sitting in church with him one day, and it was the third assassination attempt. He survived, but this time somebody was killed beside her, and she was deeply traumatized by that event. But he told her, "Marlene, no, those people are evil. They will not win. There are more good people in the world than there are bad people, and we will triumph." And she lived by that dictum the rest of her life. And then when she matured, she fell in love with a journalist who was himself murdered for uncovering corruption. And that was in 1989. And she said, "I too will follow in that footsteps." And she got a job with the Department of Agriculture as an agricultural chemist, discovered all kinds of corruption in there, and dedicated her life to exposing that corruption.
Money never getting to people for agricultural projects.
Millions upon millions of dollars right. being sucked from the poorest of farmers who earn less than a dollar a day, kicked upstairs to the people that ran the Department of Agriculture and to politicians so they could win elections. In 2004, there was a presidential election, and most of the money that was supposed to go to the farmers on Mindanao was being sucked into the presidential campaign of the incumbent. And she started exposing all this, and she received all kinds of threats, hand grenade and thrown into her house. And don't forget, she had four children, you know. And in 2006... The threats were becoming extreme, and she wrote a letter to the president, and she said, "It doesn't matter what happens to me. I am ready to die for this cause." And not long after that, it was Maundy Thursday, the night of the Last Supper, she'd had a spiritual experience that said just like Jesus Christ would have to rise up in order for his truth to be known, she too would have to die in order for this story in this very isolated part of the Philippines to get known. So she gave her guard the day off, and the killers, as with Bravo, walked in through the door and shot her to death in front of her children. And as she predicted, that story became world famous, and it almost brought down the president of the Philippines.
Almost.
But as with Bravo, it didn't.
And let's talk about the baby among them, a 23-year-old in Iraq. Now, the circumstances there have got to be slightly different.
Well, they're different because over 100 journalists were murdered in Iraq in a very, very short, and they're most all Iraqis. Mm-hmm. This fellow was a very lovable guy. He was 300 pounds. He was hired by the New York Times shortly after the invasion at 19 years old. He lived in the most violent neighborhood of Baghdad. He would commute to the New York Times every day, which was a perilous journey. I mean, I made that commute, and it's really it's scary. And when he was doing it between 2003 and 2007, it was even more scary.
And he was fairly obvious by his girth.
Yeah, he was easily recognizable to insurgents. And yet he would leave the walled compound of the New York Times to cover car bombings and war zones. Very, very brave guy. And he would go back to Sadia, and al-Qaeda threatened him. And the Shiite insurgents threatened him. And they told him to quit the Times. And he would walk around with a Bluetooth in his ear. He loved the fact that Americans lived in the future, whereas Iraqis lived in their past. And he thought the only way to overcome the problems of the Middle East was to live in the future and to forget the old resentments of the past. And when they told him, "Stop dressing that way and stop working for the New York Times," it was as a political statement he made, "No, I will live as a cosmopolitan Westerner, even in this Muslim society that has gone mad. In any case, he was told to leave Sadia. He was told to quit the Times. He wouldn't do it. Al-Qaeda moved into the neighborhood. He knew he was facing deadly threats. They told him this. And he said to, as with all these journalists, they predicted their deaths. He said to his fiancée, this older woman, he said, "This is the last time I'll probably see you." And it was.
He was right.
Yeah, he was right. He was not supposed to go into work on a Friday. He left to go to work to cover violence around the mosques. And they ambushed him on a road between his home and the New York Times compound. They shot him, and he became another one of those
statistics. A martyr, really, yeah. A different kind of martyr.
Now, all these journalists said these same things. Anna Politkovskaya in Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, today, as we sit here now, four journalists have been killed at her newspaper, just her newspaper alone.
Don't you think she's the most famous, though, of all of the candidates you have chosen?
She's the most famous because she had an international audience. She spoke English. She gave great interviews. She was a handsome woman. She dressed very beautifully.
A bit grumpy, perhaps.
Yes, she was like a cactus. Very, very difficult to
prickly,
get on. She worked for Novaya Gazeta, which is now a famous newspaper. After two journalists had been murdered at her paper, she stood at the funeral in a second. She said, "I will be next." And she, in fact, was next. So, in fact, I was on my way. The threats against her were so amazing. By the fall of 2006, I was going to Russia to write about two other journalists in an auto plant town of Tolyatti, called Detroit of Russia. These are two guys, Valery Ivanov and Alexei Sidorov. They, too, were under daily threat. And I wanted to find out what it took for guys like Ivanov and Sidorov to stay on a story even though you know you get killed. And everyone's saying, Politkovskaya is the one you got to talk to because she lives with that same threat. So I had made an appointment to interview on her in October 10th, 2006 in Moscow, and I left for Moscow on October 7th, and she had written me an email saying, "Check in town when you get in, and we can get together." And when I landed in Moscow the night of October 7th, I phoned a contact in Moscow and said I'd arrived, and they said, "Well, you're too late. She was shot today." In the lobby to her house. She was murdered. So she became another chapter in my book. And I found, as consistent with all the other journalists, she too had had a transformative experience. She had grown up as part of the metropolitan elite of a Soviet family. Her parents were UN. They were delegates to the United Nations for the Soviet Union. And she was raised in very privileged circumstances. And when she became a journalist in her early 20s, she focused on the elite intelligentsia. And after Glasnost and the fall of the Soviet Union, she continued writing about the privileged elite. She phoned up a human rights organization in 1996, and she said, "I would like to write a story about big-eyed Chechen children going to their first day of school." And the person that ran the organization said, "Well, they can't go to school, but if you come down, there are some Chechens here because we've just bombed Grozny." This is in 1996. Mm-hmm. She walked in the door, and she saw 100 people lining the walls of the refugee center. These were kids that had just lost parents. These were parents that had just lost a husband or just lost relatives. These were wounded people. Lots of wailing. And she looked at them and she looked at herself and she said, "What have I been doing with my journalism career? What am I good for?" That was her transformative moment, her epiphany. From that day forward, she dedicated herself to writing about the Chechen cause and the cause of other ethnic minorities and bringing down that organized criminal structure that Russia is run according to. And when the Second Chechen War started, she went down there and she made 50 trips to there. And sometimes she went in the trunks of cars and dressed as a peasant. She was hunted by the SFB. She insulted Putin. She insulted the generals while she moved amongst them. And eventually they caught up with her on October 7, 2006, the night I landed in Russia that afternoon.
Well, you know, you've been have been put in vulnerable positions as well. Yep. I mean, I don't know how tough it's been for you, but you must have had a transformative moment as well, because you have written lots and lots of stories about people who are corrupt or who live on the nasty edge. And I'm sure you've had the odd phone call.
Yeah. In my career, I've been under police protection for 6 months as a result of a Chinese mob boss I was chasing around. But while the police were living in the house, there was not one moment when I was frightened that they would be the ones who would come upstairs and put a bullet in my head. They were there to protect me, mm-hmm. and I never doubted that they would protect me. I didn't think they would take a bribe from the
yes.
Chinese mafia. These people all stood on their own, knowing that if they were under police protection, it would probably be the
police. That
would
be the police that would do it.
Yeah.
But what I meant to ask you was, why are you in this area of your business?
Why
are you brave? Why are you braver than yeah. I am? Why do you do this?
Okay. At the
Same
moment,
reasons?
At the moment, I can explain it this way. I just spent the last 4 years talking to dozens and dozens of mourning relatives. When these journalists died, their lives and work exploded, and a piece of them went all around them. And when I wanted to put these people back to life again. I wanted to take these pieces that were stuck in the mother and in the wife and in the brother and in the sister, and I wanted to reassemble them. I didn't want them to just die in that horrible way and be forgotten about. Some are still remembered, but many are forgotten now. And I wanted, I loved them. I got to tell you that by studying their lives through the torn hearts of their children and their parents and their husbands and their wives, I came to really love them, like as if I knew them.
But you knew every one of them after their death.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, maybe I knew them better than I would have if I'd known them alive, because I probably would have just spoken to them, and they would have given me what it was that they wanted me to know, and their relatives would have been hesitant about talking about their other sides, because these were not saints, and that's why they were heroes, because they overcame their fears, they overcame their negative tendencies, and in fact, they converted their negative tendencies into positive forces that allowed them to face death.
Well, I'll tell you that I was very impressed with this book, and there isn't a journalism student alive that shouldn't get their hands on this, and civilians too.
Thank you.
Terry Gould, Murder Without Borders, Dying for the Story in the World's Most Dangerous Places. It's published by Random House Canada. You are listening to the Sunday Edition podcast, and I'm Vicki Gaboreau.